Hello there, Richard Del Conner, philosopher, poet. name I used to perform under for several years, and I wrote the book Philosopher Poet in a Field of Dreams. Hopefully you have that book already. I'm going to read a poem from that book, and it's available at Amazon. It's a paperback book, so you can order it up and get it printed. When I see you, I'll autograph it. And today's poem, this is 007. This is episode 007 of Richard Del Conner, Philosopher Poet. And James Bond was one of my heroes. I don't know if I'd call him a role model. I mean, basically, he's the king of deception and philandering and cheating. There's one of my favorite movies is actually Inner Majesty's Secret Service. And he actually got married. Now, how long he would have been monogamous or how well that would have worked, I don't know. But very, very excellent movie. I think it's maybe there's a few of them I really like, but it's one of my favorites, if not my favorite, James Bond movie. And it doesn't even star Sean Connery. That's an excellent movie. Which kind of relates to today's theme, which is about kind of infidelity or in a weird way. But anyway, okay, so let's see. Okay, so there's the intro. Let's get to work here. The poem I'm going to read from my book, Philosopher, Poet in a Field of Dreams. Go to Amazon and get your copy. I'm going to read the poem Family Tools. And you'll notice that it actually references Hebrew women and Hindu women. And let me look here a little bit. I guess maybe modern women and let's see. Anybody? Okay, so it's a very vague poem in that sense. It's trying to be more philosophical and generic. I've got some other poems and stories that kind of deal with, well, yeah, this is, man, it's hard to tell the truth without pissing somebody off. But Family Tools, it's about men basically being the tool of the family. And in my family, which is the story of that's the American Zen story. If you get the American Zen albums produced by me for Shaolin Records, in fact, I think I wrote that, was that going to be the kind of the story for today? Yeah, so I'll tell you a little story about that. When I had a daughter, Caitlin, and decided that I was running a record company. I said, I don't want to have kids. And if I am going to have kids, I want to stay home and, you know, do my record company and I can perform at night. And I was teaching some kung fu. And I said, you know, if anybody's going to have to go out and get a job, because I did not want to do union carpentry anymore. I'd been a union carpenter since 1972, and this was 1992, or 1989 when we started. She was born in 1991. I don't want to go out and get a day job and raise this family. That's not what I'm about. I'm an artist. I want my record company. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to have a media company. I want to be a media mogul. I want to have a movie company, a record company, a music publishing company. And so I don't want to just go out and get a job and, you know, pay for the kids. That's just not what I want to do. So I made a deal with my wife. And it was good for a few years. And then she broke the deal and ran off and left me used me as a family tool. In fact, she used to say, well, if you're not going to raise the kids, then, you know, I'm going to throw you out in the street and then sue you for support. So basically, I kind of suffered through a crappy marriage and raised my daughter. And she went off and had what she called an open marriage. And I didn't have any other lovers, but she did. Who knows how many. She got engaged to a couple of different guys, but almost got married again herself while I was still raising Caitlin when she was about 8 years old. But anyway, let's see. So yeah, I was the family tool. So this is kind of a story about how men are family tools. They basically are there just slaves to the family, you know, just to basically be a tool, literally. That's funny when you call a man a tool, and yeah. And that's what husbands are. They're family tools. And one of the most famous, of course, would be Joseph. The term cuckold actually comes from the cuckoo bird. I'm not an expert on this topic, but as I recall, the cuckoo bird is famous for actually going and laying its eggs in other birds' nests, and then the other birds raise her young because she doesn't want to stay home and raise the kids. And so that's what kind of cuckolding is a woman will have relationships with other men and get pregnant by them, and then the husband will have to raise those kids and pay for them, support them, and pretend to be their father, even though he's not actually their father. So yeah, the men are tools, and and so Jesus is the offspring of what's her name, Mary Magdalene, or his mom, who was said, oh, always claimed that her husband was not the father of her son, but Joseph raised him anyway, and never heard anything about him treating him bad. But Joseph never gets any credit for actually even raising him, putting a roof over his head and food in his stomach and clothes on his body, and Mary was just having babies by other men. I don't know if he had a couple other brothers, and I don't know if they were by Joseph. Nobody ever says they were, but yeah, I've always kind of presumed they were, but there's never been anything that ever said they were. So I don't know how many husbands she had. She claims that one was God. That's a pretty illustrious claim to make. Oh, it was God who's the father. So I don't know how she got away with that, but I maybe they kind of kept it a secret, because that's kind of the thing that, you know, back in those days, I think they stoned women to death if they went off and had sex with other men or babies by other men besides their husband. So anyway, but yeah, so Joseph was one of the most ancient family tools, I guess. So anyway, here we go. Family tools. Here we go. And it actually starts with the Hebrew concept. And it mentioned the Hindus. Now, in the old Hindu Vedic scriptures, which are about 4,000 years old, they may go back to before the Torah. There's an interesting passage in there that says that the woman is the only one who knows who the father of the children are, because the man's off at work, and when they have a kid, you know, I mean, maybe the guy looks a little like her husband, so it's not very obvious. But if he doesn't look like the husband, it can be very obvious. I had a friend who had that happen to him. In fact, his dad was the one who set up the marriage and everything. He knew this woman from the church. This was a big Catholic thing, and she was Catholic, and he was Catholic, and dad was Catholic, and the dad said, "Oh, here's a good Catholic girl, you know, and you should marry her." And they hit it off. She was really pretty, really beautiful woman, and they got married, and then she got pregnant by her last boyfriend. He came and visited her and got her pregnant, and when the baby was born, it was very obvious that it was her ex-boyfriend's and not his. So he raised her for maybe 7 years or something before finally she actually took the kid, and then divorced him and married the previous boyfriend. And, you know, so he spent 7 years raising that kid, being a tool, the family tool, and totally lost out. And he really, I used to tell me stories about how he raised the kid, and I was very envious. He was actually a really, really good father in a lot of ways, and he really enjoyed being the father. It's a real shame that it wasn't his kid. And then what did he get out of that? Then he never saw her again. The mom took her off, and whammo, I don't think he ever saw her again. So yeah, he was definitely a family tool. Okay, here we go. Family tools. The Torah was written by women. The Bible by men. The Hindus have the most keys to heaven, but I prefer the godless Zen. The rules we choose, which require us to lose, are surely the denials of wives. When the matriarchs cry, "Revenge!" it's the men who will avenge the meaning of their lives. If God did make rules, we are certainly fools, like children disobeying their dad. But if the rules were better, no more people would follow them to the letter, because we still do what makes us glad. So the rules by women or fathers or gods are only as strong as a woman's devotion. Each mother obeys until loyalty clogs her freedom of emotion. It's a man's world with woman rules, designed to keep the men as family tools. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting little poem, but that, you know, it's just the truth of it. And you got to remind, you know, and it's usually the reverse. I mean, like I said, I was kind of the reverse of that. I was the woman who basically got left at home, and then the father runs off and, you know, and has relationships and jobs or travels, and maybe goes on tour or has a mistress somewhere else, you know. And so it was kind of a, I hear my cat scratching. Hold on. Come on in, Bear. He just won't leave me alone. If I close this door, he's got to knock. Well, what? I've already fed you 10 times today. It's, I'm not gonna feed you again. It's like almost midnight now. Nope, I'm not gonna feed you. So what do you want? You're just getting jealous. He's jealous because I'm spending time with you. So, oh, it's not that one, is it? I can't translate that one. Go eat your dry food. If that was a food thing, go eat your dry food. Okay, I always keep. I got this big container, you know, and the dry food kind of trickles out of it as he eats it and he gets more. And I just filled it up with fresh food yesterday. And then I bought him another bag today. And then I went over to Target a couple of days ago and bought like 20 cans of cat food. But in order to get free checking at Wells Fargo, I have to have 10 swipes on my ATM card. And I've really frustrated tellers saying, oh, can you ring up 10 items individually and, you know, use my card 10 times? And I figured out a better way to do that. I go to the self-serve over at Target and buy 10 cans of its cat food individually purchased. And then I pay for the rest in one big group. But I got to get those 10 swipes on my card so I get that free checking every month. Otherwise, I got to pay like, what, 15, 18 bucks for my checking account. So anyway, that was Family Tools. He kind of interrupted me, which may be a good thing. I was kind of mentioning about how I was kind of the reverse of the woman left at home of a father runs off and has a life, supposedly. Well, in my case, I mean, I had a life. I really enjoyed raising the kids. In fact, I was in like heaven. It was really, I don't think any mother could ever enjoy raising her daughter as much as I enjoyed raising my daughter. She was my best friend for, gosh, maybe 10 years. In fact, I would say she was the longest best friend I've ever had in my whole life. And maybe the bestest of my bestest friends, because I mean we had just a wonderful relationship, and I invested everything into her and just cherished her and just really appreciated being with her and doing everything with her and dragging her around to my kung fu classes and music and being on television with her, and you know she went everywhere I went for years, and I really enjoyed that, walking her to school and back and forth every day, and yeah, and going on hikes, you know, like 5 days a week, we'd go on hikes up to the canyon and watching cartoons, anime, Prince Arislan. In fact, I just texted her yesterday and was reminding her about this one cartoon anime series we used to watch together back in the 90s called The Heroic Adventures or Legend of Arslan. And it's a wonderful, wonderful series, and they've remade it. I think I like the original better, but they're both good. And it's a true story, I guess, of a prince who had a really tough life. And but he's one of his protectors is named Ferengazi, and she was a temple warrior, a woman. And my daughter Caitlin kind of saw her as a role model, I think. And it was kind of fun watching that series the other day, and seeing Ferengazi and remembering my daughter has kind of looked at her as a role model as a warrior woman. Because she was learning kung fu with me too, so you see, that's what I mean. I invested everything. I actually thought she'd be running my school right now, but kind of like the my friend's story. After a certain age, my wife took the kids and they were gone, and it's like, oh, I kind of thought I was going to be with them the rest of my life, but I don't even see them anymore or talk to them, and so they're not really a part of my life whatsoever. So. Interesting investment. You know, you put everything into your children, and especially like I did. I mean, I more than most people kind of looked at my kids as an investment, which was a mistake. You know, I should have had somebody else raise them, but then I wouldn't have had all those experiences. I mean, it was really I had a great time being a kid again. In fact, I went to a counselor some years ago, a family counselor for some months, And I told her that I looked at raising my daughter as kind of like my second childhood. And she goes, you've told me your life story. You never had a childhood. That was your first childhood. And that was kind of true. And I was her best friend. And that's one of the reasons I think that I was a crappy parent, was because really she saw me more as a friend and a daycare worker and not really the stern father image, you know, who you had to fear. And I was just there at her beck and call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so I don't think she ever really saw me as a father or a parent. I was kind of more like her friend. And so maybe that's why it's easier for her to not have me in her life, because I got lots of friends that I don't really miss. So so where were we? Family Tools. Yeah, I was a family tool. Yeah, the story of my being a family tool is in the first two American Zen albums. And the first album, I thought everything was going to go really good. So when you, the poetry and the songs is all about my love, nurturing your life is about raising Caitlin as a toddler and just really loving her and appreciating her, but wanting to care for her and make sure she didn't even stub her toes, you know, just really being maybe overly protective. And the second album is where it took place a few years later, and my wife had already left me, really. And I was trying to, we were kind of, I guess, in kind of a couple of limbos where, you know, we didn't sleep together for like a year, but then we were trying to get back together and maybe not. And you know, I was kind of stuck there, and she was living there, even though she was gone a lot, but I was trying to maybe make the marriage happen again. And so this on the second album, like Just For You, that's kind of a pleading song for her, you know, saying, hey, you know, I'm here for you, you know, leave the past behind and let's have a future together. But we kind of came close, but no, it didn't happen. You know, once you break a relationship, it can never be re-sewn or rejoined. You know, it just goes until it's gone and that's it. And I've never heard of anybody making a good second wind out of a marriage. It just doesn't work. You know, you get one try at it, and then once it's broken, you know, and that's all there is to it. So, but anyway, yeah, I learned a lot, though. Interesting. I've had an interesting life, despite the failure of it. It's been quite the learning experience, to say the least. Now, I was supposed to play flute on these shows, but I didn't even bring my flute in here. I actually was trying to. The song that I played in the last podcast, Pictures of Home, is supposed to have flute. And several years ago, I had the flute all ready to record. I really wish I would have recorded it. I should have just recorded it in my car. I was living in my car at the time, and I should have recorded it because I really had it down. And I could feel it, and I knew the story, and I knew what was happening, and I could envision the things that were happening at the border crossing in Afghanistan or wherever that was, you know, in that soldier's story, and when he was telling me, and I could see these events and certain things happening, and the suicide bomber, and so I could actually put the drama into that flute as I was playing it. And in fact, sometimes I couldn't play it all the way through because I start crying. It was so sad, and I'm gonna start crying now if I think about it too much, but yeah, I'm kind of choked up right now. It's a horrible story, beautiful song, but a horrible story. Anyway, that's Pictures of Home. So anyway, I was going to try to jam along with it, but I couldn't figure out how to put the song on my four-track recorder, which is where I record it, but put it back in there so I could hear it and play along with it. And I wasn't able to figure it out, and I got frustrated and realized, I'll have to pass on that for right now. But I do need to record that flute somehow, so I'm going to have to figure that out, figure out a way I can hear it and play along with it again, because it's not in my recorder anymore. Okay, I took that disc out and erased it. But it's in my computer. So let's see. Anyway, where were we? So I'm not going to play any flute today. So yeah, let's I'll make this album ad. I'm supposed to do an album ad in each podcast. Level 1 equals Peace of Mind by American Zen. That was actually recorded in 1993, about the story from 1991 to 93, those couple years, of raising my toddler child as a, I was like the mother, I was a Mr. Mom. So go get that album, and yeah, that's the, it's a great album. It's recorded 4-track. There's no overdubs on that. The next album was 4-track, but I actually then put some overdubs on it when I released it in 2007. But the first album is just 4 tracks. It's just a bass on one, a bass and drums on one track, a guitar on another track, and then a vocal and an acoustic, well, no, I thought, what is it? It's acoustic guitar and drums. That's one track. And then I would put a bass on another track and a guitar on the third track, and that would leave the 4th track for vocals. And if you hear an organ, I'm playing the organ and singing together on the same track. So I'm putting those two things together and mixing them onto one track. So that's how that album was recorded. And a lot of people say it's their favorite album. It's like, what? You know, that was the most difficult and primitive recording. But it is, in a sense, it's a beautiful album. And it's recorded as well as you can. I mean, it's recorded as well as the early Beatle recordings. I mean, I really did a good job. I used to be a recording engineer in the 70s. So I would actually demagnetize the heads before every recording. I mean, I did it totally professionally. Anyway, so that, get Level 1 equals Peace of Mind by American Zen. And that's when the family was a beautiful thing. That's when I was enjoying being a father. That's when I was enjoying being a tool. I was happy to be a family tool. I was loving being a family tool. It was great being a family tool. It couldn't have been any better. I mean, it's a shame that it's so long ago. We're talking 1991 and it's 2021. That was 30 years ago. And those memories are not as strong as, you know, I wish they were. I'm glad that I have some semblance of remembrance, but no, those songs are key to my memories better than anything. So Yeah, go listen to that album. It's a good album. It was recorded when the family was really totally held together, and yeah. So let's see. For the philosophy of RDC, now the American Zen albums, there's 8 levels. Now, when I started that journey, I realized, because I had been teaching Buddhism and I had just launched my Shaolin Kung Fu school, and my band American Zen, our slogan was America's first Buddhist rock band, and that's true because nobody's ever contested that claim ever since then. That's America's first Buddhist rock band. And we were on a Buddhist journey of 8 levels. Every album represents a different spiritual level. The first level is just survival and finding peace of mind. That's what level 1 is, peace of mind. How to find contentment as a human being on earth. The second level is where you add religion to it. That's why it's called Christ Killer. Because a lot of people think you're supposed to kill Christ in order to get to heaven. We can get into that another time. But the second, because I was dealing with the Mormons too, And so, I just don't believe that you actually should think that you can kill someone and then you're going to get a better place in the afterlife. I think that's totally wrong and you're never going to sell me on it. And I finally, was a pepper tree Catholic for years, and then I was an atheist, and then I tried to still be friendly with them. But no, I finally had to say, no, there's no way I can say that, killing Christ was a good idea. I'm sorry. And I'm not even going to pretend it's a good idea anymore. I totally think it's wrong. I don't think you should ever kill somebody and think you're going to have a better afterlife when you don't even know for sure there is an afterlife. So killing people in this world just so you can have a better time and more fun when you're dead, that just is totally illogical to me. And I'm the philosopher poet now, so that philosophy is impossible for me to accept. Impossible. So I don't care what you're going to promise me in my afterlife. It's just that anybody who can believe that is obviously somebody who's, is a moron. And 40% of all the people in America basically are D students, C- and D students and F students. So they can easily be sold on those type of concepts, They're the ones who believe that. They're the fanatics. In fact, the more fanatical they get, the more stupid they are. That's just the way you can tell. The more people yell and scream like America's great or this and that, the more they bond and support these stupid slogans, make America green green is maybe a good concept. But let's see, make America great, green, anything. But basically, you got to say, make America green, I guess, has certain ways to accomplish that. But making America great, I've never heard anybody who gave that slogan say how to actually do it and what great is. But let's not get off on that politics. Let's not get there. Anybody who's listening to this podcast is probably, hopefully, not part of that 40%. Because if you're part of that 40%, you're never going to understand what I'm saying anyway. Even when I was in elementary school, I was an outcast. I was ostracized. Kids called me brain because I was a straight-A student. So the people who are stupid do not like smart people. They don't like smart things. They don't like smart ideas. And it's kind of like a crook. A crook doesn't like a cop. And a cop doesn't like a crook. They're on opposite ends of the spectrum. So stupid people don't like smart people, and smart people don't really like stupid people. I mean, I've kind of made an exception on that. Like, I talk about my cat being a total idiot, but I love my cat. And I loved my kids, even if they weren't really that smart. Well, actually, they were kind of smart. It was amazing what I did with them. They were B and A students, B-plus students, A-minus students when I raised them. But the moment I stopped raising them, they went down to D students. It was like, what? I didn't think it was all me. I thought I was just helping them. But anyway, so that's how I know I can make people smarter. But where were we? The philosophy of 8 levels. So the first level is just peace of mind. The second level is where you add religion and slogans and you fight each other and you kill each other and say, my religion's better than yours, and so I need to kill you to prove it. Something like that. I don't know. And then the third level is I want you to love me. And that's basically the Buddhism level. That's where Buddhism starts. It's above religion. It's where you say, okay, all the religions have something good to say, and all the things that I don't like you're going to say, I'm just going to tune you out so I can get along with you. And that's the level 3, where you accept everybody. Same with races and nationalities and everything, you can accept all nationalities. Even if you don't like spicy food, you can still like Mexican people. And if you don't like sour sour food. You can still like German people, sauerkraut. So anyway, you can basically ignore the things you don't like, and you'll find something you like. Like with my cat. But that's the third level, where you accept everybody and try to love everybody for what good you can find in them. And then the level four is where you actually learn how to make people healthier and happier. And that's where you become like not just a person who's enjoying other people. It's like, hey, let me help you to learn how to enjoy. So you're actually smart enough to be able to help people be smarter. And so that's the fourth level, the Kung Fu Cowboy, where you're out there helping people to be smarter. And then the fifth level and the sixth level were, surprisingly, when I joined the Lakota Sioux and became a pipe carrier and did my vision quest on the Rosebud, the Pine Ridge Reservation. The chief called me an elder of the tribe, and I can mention all kinds of famous people you'd know that, you know, I befriended and said, oh, come visit me anytime. And unfortunately, being a Mr. Mom and not getting away from my kids 24/7, I didn't take advantage of a lot of those things, and I kind of regret it because some of those people are dead now. And but yeah, I was quite the... I was totally immersed in the American Native American Lakota Sioux traditions and their religious ceremonies and the pipe ceremonies and everything. So that's what the fifth and sixth level are. So they're basically a different type of spirituality that's not really a religion and not really rules. It was harmonizing with nature and accepting nature. And then the sixth level is realizing that you're dedicating yourself to the tribe, to your culture, to your city, to your state, to your country. So that's a kind of a higher level of raising a family, except now you're giving yourself to the community. So that's the level six. And then the level seven was end of the line. And that's where I was homeless and in my car, and I was making my Kung Fu Cowboy movies. And that was just kind of realizing my independence, my individuality, and I was kind of abandoned, left for out there. But I kind of just was a lone spirit, you know. And you got to come to that reality that if you are going to die, and there is a spiritual world out there, you know, you don't have a family. There's no such thing as family in the spirit world. You don't go find your relatives and move in with them, you know, after you're dead. You know, you got to learn how to basically be an individual spirit. That's why most people reincarnate. They can't handle that. You know, they can't be just an individual spirit out there floating around with a purpose or just trying to discover a purpose. They can't even figure that out while they're alive. And then the level eight is actually the Memorial Day album. And that was, I recorded that in 2014 on Memorial Day. And I had always known that the last album, like I said, that you've got to kind of like get your spirit ready for death, in a sense, in level seven, kind of come to the meaning of life and get past mortal reality and materialism, and then go into a spiritual life. And so that's what I was kind of doing in level seven. And then level eight was, I didn't know how, I figured level eight's got to have some connection to the afterlife. You've got to basically have some one foot in the grave or something. You got to know what death really is. You know, I figured, okay, I didn't have any, when I started the eight levels and I was raising my daughter in 1991, I had no idea, you know, what that eighth level was going to be, but I thought somehow I got to, you know, have my foot, you know, in the spiritual world. Well, it kind of was the weirdest thing. They kind of came to me, and I talked about that, I think, a little bit in the last podcast. They, on Memorial Day, I had these, like, voices in my head, which maybe were ghosts. Maybe they were just my imagination. Maybe I'm so creative, you know, that, yeah, wow, I could invent people in my brain. But they told me these stories, which, you know, which maybe one day we'll flesh out, and I can provide the details, and we might even be able to figure out who those real people were in real life. But anyway, in that case, that's not how I was planning to do it or what I expected. But I considered, okay, that's level eight then. Okay, that was my connection to the spiritual world, you know, talking to dead people. So anyway, that's the eighth level of. So it's an eight level journey, American Zen. So where were we? The RDC story, level one, raising Caitlin. Yeah, I raised my daughter 24/7. My wife had a great job working for Xerox, and we had insurance, and, you know, we had enough to support ourselves. And then I made enough money in my Kung Fu to basically cover my own expenses so I can have my recording company and start my own, have my own business, you know. And so even though we were kind of separated, kind of divorced, we had a weird kind of marriage. I mean, we were never legally married. What we did was, we both decided. I said, you know, do you want to have a baby? You know, do you want to just actually make a baby on purpose? And we decided, yeah, that would be a cool thing. And it was. When I've spent my whole life trying not to have a baby, and sex is a lot of fun even then. But when you can have sex, you know, and you're actually trying to make a baby, it's, well, it's even more fun. So I got to say. So anyway, so where were we? I got too much into my memory there. But yeah, so level one is about that having a family. We decided to have a family, and I was going to stay home and raise the kid and have my own business, and she would go off and have a job, and, you know, and that was somehow we'd make that harmonize. And for about 4 years, it really worked great. We had a really good family. I thought we had a good family. Evidently, she didn't, because, like I said, she ended up leaving me. But, yeah, so anyway, no, I don't want to get into the negative, because, like I said, this level one album is a real positive. I actually, the last song on the album is called Thank You, and it's written to Michelle. It even says, "Thank you, Michelle," at the very end. I just, when I was done singing, I say, "Thank you, Michelle." So you know, that album is about totally appreciating her and enjoying it and enjoying the family and believing that it was going to really last forever. So anyway, so get that album. That's a lovely, romantic, loving family album. And so yeah, level one equals Peace of Mind by American Zen. So let's see. Now I'd planned this thing, remember, several years ago. And the end song, I was, like I said, I was going to try to do the Pictures of Home again and try to play flute to it, but that's not going to happen, at least not today. And so the song I scribbled into here is What Do We Have Now, which kind of relates to it. It's about love that you think is going to last forever. And it's actually written kind of about the, it was inspired by an Ingrid Bergman movie in which she was a Jew who was kind of like during the middle of World War II and hiding in during the Holocaust, but, you know, it's in Europe. And it was a beautiful story, black and white, I think. I saw it, you know, about 30 years ago, but it was just so moving to me, the love or whatever, or the drama of that. And so the song, What Do We Have Now? Well, I actually wrote that in 1977, so sheesh, I must have seen that when I was a kid, that movie. But What Do We Have Now is about two people who are in a war, and they're under a bridge, and it even says, as the soldiers, you know, are parading over the bridge, and you're hiding underneath it, eating a rusted can of pork and beans, you know. And you're with this woman, and you're just saying, I'm just so glad to be with you, and I love you. And even in the most dire, scary, dirty, you know, depressed, wretched situation, to have someone you love and be there and sharing that love. That's what the song is. It's about. It's a story of watching people be assassinated and killed right in front of you as you're hiding in the bushes, you know, behind a picket fence. It's a dramatic song. What Do We Have Now? But it's about love. It's about what do we have now? And it's saying that, well, what we have now is our love. And unfortunately, as I was saying in a different podcast series, I was talking about, well, does love really exist? And, you know, I've always thought it did, obviously. I mean, look at me writing these songs about love will, you know, survive, you know, murder and killing and starvation and poverty. So I honestly had this weird concept that love actually could be the surviving, perpetuating factor. And I've always had that until, I guess, the last decade when I lost my family, lost my kids, lost my wife, lost my everything, and got nothing now. And realized that, wow, I had all that love, you know, and I never cheated on her or did anything bad to her. I never beat my kids or my wife, or, you know, wasn't a drunken father. I never drank. And so all the negative things that most people accept and still, you know, and the kids still love their parents even after getting beaten up by them when they're drunk, you know. And my kids don't have the bad memories, but I still don't have the relationship. So there's a few things about it that I'll always resent, obviously. You know, because I still love my kids. In fact, every morning, even when I was homeless, I'd always wake up thinking of my kids, because I did that for so many years. The first thing I would do is worry about my kids. I'd have to wake them up, get them dressed, get them clean, maybe showered. Well, I always showered them the night before, and get them off to school. And so my first thing when I woke up for years, even when I was homeless, was I'd always think of my kids. And then I'd get all depressed, and I'd think about it, and I get more depressed thinking about my kids. And I always thought, well, as soon as I get a house and I get a girlfriend or something, you know, that'll break that cycle. Well, the only thing I finally, after years and years, I mean, I'm talking like, I don't know how many, 10 years, 10 years? Yeah, 10 years of thinking of my kids every day, and they were gone after they'd left me, and I still thought of them every morning. The one thing that actually broke me of that mental cycle was when I was in the homeless shelter. And boy, I was in a small, 10 by 10 room with four beds with just enough room for two people to walk between them. And that's it. Four beds in a 10 by 10 room. And there was, three other criminals. Well, one guy was a murderer. The other guy was a junkie and a crack salesman. And the other guy was a drunk and a crack addict. And them snoring and farting and coughing and then fighting to get into the bathroom in the morning, to get a shower every day. It was that broke me of that system. I stopped thinking about my kids. I don't think about them now when I wake up. I mean, maybe once in a while, but very rarely now. But that's what broke me of that thing in my brain that I was trained myself. I was a family tool, remember? So I was literally programmed to always think of my kids first thing in the morning when I woke up. And that lasted 10 years when they were gone and I was living all by myself. I still thought of them every single morning. But yeah, it wasn't until I got into that homeless shelter that it broke me of that. And I didn't think of them the first thing in the morning. and I realized that after about a year, I go, hey, I'm not thinking about my kids every morning, So, but that's what broke that chain. That's when I stopped being the family tool. Was, yeah, being in that little prison. And it was kind of like a prison, but I could leave whenever I wanted. But if you were gone for 3 days, you lose your bed. And, I got stories and poems about that place. We'll get to that later in the Philosopher Poet series. This is actually, the Philosopher Poet, these poems were actually written when I was living there. These are when I first moved. No, actually, some of these were written when I spent 6 months at the Martin Luther King Hospital. I recuperated from a surgery. And then after the surgery, I qualified for Section 8 because now I was not only a homeless person, but I was also a senior. And I'd gone through this medical program and they'd housed me at Martin Luther King. So now I could actually get Section 8 housing. And but until I got my housing, they put me in that homeless shelter for a year. And they said I'd only going to be there for a few weeks. That was, anyway. Boy, I got stories to tell you. So anyway, I was a philosopher poet the entire year I was there and at that homeless shelter. And okay, so here we go. The song you're going to hear, I got to go find it on my computer. I know it's in there somewhere. It better be. What Do We Have Now? And it's a beautiful romantic song of two people who have an entire world of hell around them, but they have the ultimate, I'm getting all choked up thinking about it. They have all this love for each other. Okay, that's it. Philosopher Poet out of here.
Clouds crumble and the wind melts warm as mountains evaporate into the mirage. My vision fades and goes. Where we dreams lie the charcoal tree. As we cough on the smoke and choke with tears, we've forgotten what we know. Standing in the rain, there's no room to cry. Nothing to trust, nowhere to go but where we will die. miserable. Well, it was true.